Oh, we're going to go into the annual wolf update now. Donnie Mattarello, I hope you're ready.
Always.
You got a smile, thank God.
Good morning, Vice Chair, Commissioners, Director Suswin. Again, my name is Donnie Mattarello. I'm the Wolf Policy Lead for Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'd like to quickly thank Commissioner Keeney for all of your work. It's been an honor and great to work with you over the years. And thank our new director for engaging at the level you already have in wolf conservation management. I know the honeymoon has been short, but really appreciate all his engagement in the short time he's been here. So quick overview of the items I have to discuss with you today, and I'll have some other members be coming up here to chat with you in a moment. Going to give you a quick update on some current activities and updates, a little bit on the our process moving forward for the SEPA process for considering wolf translocation. Going to shift gears then and talk about what you see on the wall here and the handouts that you have about the roles and responsibility from the department, the commission, and the Wolf Advisor Group on our process looking forward for development of a post delisting wolf conservation management plan. And during that time, I'll be asking three WAG members who are here today to come up and help share and describe what you see on the board and in your hand or on the wall and in your handout. And then three other department staff will be coming up to give you a science presentation. So I'll start with start with the current activities and updates. So you heard a lot this morning about the department's data sharing program. I'd like to start with just kind of acknowledgement of the discussion on the trust issue. It was never our intent to talk about the data sharing and the overview that we have in a way that would diminish trust in the department. And so I mean that sincerely for myself and from the department. We take the trust issue very, very seriously. And if we've lost trust, we're going to do all that we can to earn that trust back. The data sharing program has been around for about 5 years. In the last almost 2 years now, we've been looking at that data sharing program just as an opportunity to look at what's working and what's not working. Are there updates and improvements that we can provide with information we now have from Washington? So some of those that we've been talking about and you've heard a little bit about is things like improving the data sharing agreement, the actual contract agreement that we have for sharing sensitive fish and wildlife information, so that's a more robust agreement. Having a program where, and so you know, this is a program where folks can actually log in and look at wolf location data on a website to see where wolves are and in the past 14 days. So now one of the changes is incorporating it so the users can, and we have these data sharing programs with livestock producers, range riders, and county officials. Another item that we have is a change is that allowing the users the ability to change their password on their own. Before, we had to do that on our side. It was very cumbersome. You heard a little bit about the blackout period. The blackout period is meant to protect the identity of wolves while they're denning. And in the past 5 years, that's been about March. It's been March 15th through June 1st. We now have, and we were estimating the denning period based on populations in other states. We now have our own database of when Washington wolves den. And so one of the adjustments was shifting that blackout period to overlap when wolves are actually denning in Washington from April 1st to July 15th. Duly noted that does extend into after turnout on federal grazing lands, and so we've tried to incorporate a program where we still get that information to range riders and to producers verbally rather than through the online tool. And then you've heard a lot about the blob, the blue blob, and I'm going to describe that a little bit different to give you some context to it. But one of the ideas was to, in the past 5 years, it's just been point data that shows the date of where the wolf was and over the past 14 days is what producers and range riders see. And a recognition that that is just of the collared wolf, one or two in a pack, and that there are many wolves in a pack where you don't know where they are. So there is a slight tendency, not by all, but a tendency to kind of focus in on those points as where the wolves are, and try to provide another way to look at the information that still describes wolf presence, but in a way that describes where it's likely to have wolf activity versus where a wolf is as it's moving across the landscape at any particular time and day, so that producers have a better understanding to be able to look at that information and see where there's a good likelihood that there's going to be multiple wolves, whether they're collared or not, where those activity centers are. So that's what you're hearing as the blue blob. What that, to give you an analogy of what that is a, it's like a weather map where the intensity on the outer ring is less wolf intensity activity, and as you get closer to the inner rings, like on a weather map where the storm is the most severe, that that is where the wolf activity is at the highest. And so that is a data summary that we provided now, and along with flagging the section blocks of where the collared wolf is, or a couple collared wolves as they move through time, and you can see still the time stamp of when, as a wolf moves across the landscape, the section blocks light up at different colors. So as we met with our Fish and Wildlife, or we met with our wolf advisor group, we understood that that was a, going away from point data to those two data sources was a huge change that folks weren't ready for. And so after the last wolf advisor group, we established a 30-day learning period, if you will, where all of those, just the, I'm speaking now of the data layers, the point data, the weather map data, and the section block data are all visible to the users right now, so they can see all three of those and be able to learn how to read that weather map and section block data from the point data. And so that's where we're at now. We're in that learning period, which was scheduled to go through August 14th. So what I'd like to do now is just kind of pause there to hear any discussion or direction that the commission and director would like to have on this subject, then we'll pick up.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Not any direction, but a question. You mentioned the confidentiality agreement. Currently in the confidentiality agreement, are there any penalties for anyone who breaks a confidentiality, the terms of the confidentiality agreement?
I can't speak to that specifically in terms of legal. I'd have to go back and review it, but I will tell you my understanding is that the confidentiality agreement that we've been using up to this point didn't have a hammer, if you will, to deal with if folks were operating outside of that agreement. And the agreement that we've worked on and provided edits to provides more of a hammer if folks are outside of that. And it is in layman's terms so that folks understand that. And so that was one of the items in the confidential agreement.
Any other comments or questions? Mr. Thorburn.
Well, I guess I know, Director, this was one of the areas that you looked at even before you were officially director, and I would like to hear from you where we are, basically.
Okay, so we, it's been a couple days over, meeting with many of the folks you heard testify here this morning. We had state legislators, county commissioners, sheriff from Ferry County, ranchers, range riders, the whole crew. We had long talks about wolves, and it was absolutely universal. Every single person we talked to, this was their biggest concern, was the switch in data sharing. When I came back, I met with Donnie and other leaders within our internal wolf group, and we pretty quickly came to the consensus that this is not ready for prime time. That we still believe there's a lot of value. I think Donnie's covered it, but we heard loud and clear, don't be switching things up in the middle of a grazing season. So our proposal at this point would be to maintain all three of the layers Donnie talked about, the point source, all three layers, the blob and the point source and the section data. doesn't mean we want to abandon that, because we do think there's value in it, but we recognize we need to work with people, we need to make sure they understand it, and we need to make sure that we've adjusted it so it works for everybody. So that would be the intent, but we didn't want to make that decision until we came here and had an opportunity to, you know, get guidance from the commission.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I'm just wondering about the process here. If we were going to go through the entire presentation, or if we're pausing here, and if the commission wants to take up what the director suggested is a discussion of this and at the front table, and anything anybody would want to do right now, and if that's the case, I'd sure be interested in hearing from some of the folks down there who have worked this issue pretty hard. But I'm not sure if now's the right time, or if there's more coming that we would want to consider before that.
Well, it would seem, well, we can handle it either way you want. We can get to the end, or we can take it step by step. What's, anyone have any preference?
I prefer that we finish this now.
Yeah. Seems to be pretty important.
Okay. Commissioner Holzmiller?
Thank you, Chair. I move the commission provides policy guidance to not implement the new blue blob method as a replacement to providing WOOP present information to those who use this information to minimize wolf livestock interaction, currently scheduled to be implemented in the near future. Rather, policy direction is given to continue the current information distribution system along with the new blue blob method that when it is ready for implementation. While the dual information process occurs throughout the balance of the season, the director is charged with tasking staff to bring forward to the commission at the appropriate time over the winter analysis of the policy decision on the WOOF present information distribution for the next season to include at least the following alternatives that will achieve the goal of minimizing WOOF livestock interaction in a manner that balances the concerns of livestock producers and with those concerns of lethal removal of wolves due to livestock predation. Alternatives that are analyzed should be compared to the status quo method used to date in 2018. Alternative two, alternatives for changes to the confidentiality agreement and involve penalties for two-tiered breaching of terms of the confidentiality agreement. One tier, when a breach has occurred that does not lead to a wolf mortality, and one tier when a breach of confidentiality leads to a wolf mortality.
We have a motion. Commissioner Baker?
Second.
You second it?
Is she going to second it?
No, I was going to comment.
Do we have a second? We have a motion and a second. Commissioner Baker.
I want to begin by saying that I fully support this motion as it is presented, but I do have a concern. And my concern is that I believe from everything I've heard that from producers, from the WAG, from the department, and now from the new director, that in the next few years, the commission's going to become much more involved in wolf policy. And it's not going to be an easy few years. We're going to have some big decisions to make. So my preference would have been to leave these management decisions to the department, especially if we have a director and staff and producers that are willing to talk to each other and deal with these kind of issues. When I was over about 6 weeks ago, this wasn't a concern, but there were other concerns that possibly didn't rise to this level. A big one was payments to the people that we contract with. Range riders were upset, producers were upset, that for some reason or another, even though we've talked about this since I've been on the commission, a year and a half now, payments are still lagging. I don't see that type of thing as a commission issue. I see that kind of thing very seriously as the department, going back to this trust thing, fulfilling our side of the bargain that we're asking people who are severely impacted by these public animals. So I'll just finish by saying I do support this motion. Of course I'm going to vote for it, but I'm not 100% sure that given the circumstances, this is something that the commission needs to be doing now, especially since it was clear that it was going to happen anyway. So, thank you.
Commissioner Thorburn.
I thank you, Vice Chair. I actually am going to go even further. Well, I support the intent of the motion. In my years on the commission, have struggled with motions that come before us without a lot of prior preparation. This was an extremely long and wordy motion, and I've often found that I've supported those kinds of motions. I'm the kind of person who often thinks things over afterwards and kind of regrets sometimes my action, and I'm afraid that that might happen with this motion. I absolutely agree with what Commissioner Baker is saying. These are management issues and involve a lot of our valuable staff. And I think that the director has shown me real leadership in this issue, and I trust that the direction that you've presented to us is the direction that I definitely support. I don't think it was a good idea to drop this in the middle of the grazing season. That I really am pleased to hear that you're planning to move forward with providing all three of the data options and maybe reviewing this at a later time. And I would just leave it to you without a motion from the commission. So I am actually not going to support the motion, even though I am totally in support of the direction of the motion.
One question, Tammy. Do you have a copy, a written copy of this?
It's on the
left. Okay. Commissioner McIsaac. Dr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And I'll speak in favor of the motion as well. And I think we're all in a very good place. I know that Commissioner Holzmiller has been working on this issue for a long time. We heard some very compelling testimony from the public about in favor of not doing what had previously been planned. And it's very heartening to hear the new director, with only a few footsteps in the door on the first part of his job, to come out almost in the same spot as where this motion is. I think it's nearly identical. So I think it's all a very positive situation. There was something in the motion about confidentiality agreements that I think is nothing that was spoken to earlier, but I think the staff brought it up. And so I think everybody here is together, which is a positive thing. And I think it's responsive to the public testimony that we heard, which is a positive thing. And so I think this is all a good thing. On the question of how active should the front table here be at things that could be just delegated to the director and called management. I'm looking at the matrix report recommendations that Mr. Pamplin brought forward yesterday, and it includes greater oversight by the Fish and Wildlife Commission as one of the matrix report recommendations to occur. And of course, that means whenever it's needed. And, you know, a lot of times, maybe it's not going to need it. I agree with Commissioner Baker that I am not in favor of the commission getting into detailed management and micromanagement things, but keeping things at an elevated policy level. And I think the motion is kind of an elevated policy thing. This is apparently a very big issue. We've got people driving all the way across the state here to say something about it. Our executive assistant sent us a letter that was signed by three legislators asking for something that I think is very close to the spot this is all landing. So it's a very important thing, and I just think it's all positive here. And so I'm in favor of the motion.
Mr. Keeney.
Thank you. I think what I heard from our director is so similar to what the motion is. I'm in favor of it as well. I would think this through, though, that I don't feel we're setting a policy here. We are providing guidance to our director, who was already there as well. But it does show a unified support of making the changes that he suggested and that were read in the motion. I didn't hear differences, and I would like to ask the director, does he have any heartburn over the way this was worded, or do you feel this is just in line with what the corrective actions you're already thinking of taking?
I think the motion, as I understand it, is completely in line with where we're headed. There's a little more detail on the non-compliance with the agreement, but I think those are good ideas. I think this motion is not inconsistent with where we would like to go.
Okay. And having heard that, I'm very comfortable with it. You did get a little wordy on me there. But I was following it for the most part. So I'd like to also, though, say we are going to, or the commission is going to be more involved, I think, in as this develops in the wolf conservation plan. As we reach recovery, there's next steps that have to be considered in management. And so figuring out how we fit into that, what is policy, what isn't, you know, is going to be very, very important for all of you. So I'm in support of the motion, and I think the real thing that I feel positive about is that you were on top of this. You were up there. You made the visits. You made the connections. You listened to people. And I think that will be important, because they're hearing that you're responsive to those concerns, and the commission is responsive as well. And I think we're trying to build some of those safeguards into this, that, you know, if there's a fear that this information can be misused, which I don't believe it is. I don't believe any of the people I've known that have used data like this would ever, ever misuse it. But if there is that fear, you know, the motion carries some safeguards for that, I think. So I'm in favor.
Commissioner Graybill.
Well, I agree with what Commissioner Keeney refers to as being responsive. I hope that this motion, which I will also support, is a positive step in the direction in response to what we heard from the landowners and ranchers here today. And although I share Commissioner Thornburn's concerns about a very wordy and detailed motion that we had not viewed prior, I believe in the spirit of the message that you're providing through this is going to go a long ways to reestablish the confidence that we're trying to do the right thing on behalf of that. And it's consistent. And again, it's so important that just a week ago, our director reached out to the community and talked to those ranchers. And now here today, we're already taking action. Is a real positive step, I think, for the commission.
Okay, that being, again, Commissioner Holzmiller.
Back up what these guys said. I talk with Joel and Shelley on a pretty regular basis, and they could not be, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I know Shelley was damn near crying over this, and she appreciated so much you taking the time to come up and listen to them, and listen to them respectfully, and they could not be any happier than you taking the time to come up and do it. So you'd lit in the right spot, Kelly, and we're proud of it, and we're happy that you came in that quickly and hit in the right spot. But just, I feel that it's kind of showing that the commission is grabbing a mitt and getting in the game, too, because this is a heavy load to lift, and we all need to be standing shoulder to shoulder on this deal.
Okay, I, too, will vote for the motion for a number of reasons already stated. Okay, we call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you all. Moving on, Donnie.
Yes, thank you for the discussion and the direction. The next update is on our Togo Pack. That's in northeastern Washington in northern Ferry County. The Togo Pack is one that has been officially on our pack map since this last March. It is a pack that we had suspicions about a pack being there back in 2016, 2017, when we see the territoriality of neighboring packs and you see wolves not going into an area. It kind of gives you an idea there might be a pack there. For the Togo Pack, we had a incident in 2017, a Caught in the Act incident there in November 27th of 2017. That was another indication that there may be a pack in the Togo area. We had two depredations in the 2017, one on November 2nd and one on November 8th. More indication that we had suspicions of a pack in that area. After those depredations, we were entering the winter season when we do our surveys and there's snow on the ground. We're able to confirm, in fact, there was an existing pack there. We named that in our March 2018 annual report as the Togo Pack. We had in those two depredations that had happened in November of 2017, both of those were confirmed wolf depredations, and the producer had met the expectations that are in the plan and protocol for proactive non-lethal deterrence. After the first depredation on November 2nd, we also worked with the producer to initiate responsive deterrent measures, so in this case, added range rider activity and those kinds of things. On May 20th of this year, we had a third depredation by the Togo Pack. In that case, the producer had proactively deployed one deterrent measure. The protocol indicates at least two. Part of the update today is to share with you that we've had another 2 days ago. We've had another depredation by the Togo Pack. It was a confirmed depredation. So at that point, we've had four depredations within a 10-month rolling window. Three of those have met the expectations for non-lethal deterrent measures. One of those had not. We sat down with the region to talk about a regional recommendation for potential action in the Togo Pack yesterday. And as you all know and experienced this in the past, that things can change very quickly. Just today we've heard that there's been another confirmed depredation by the Togo Pack that was discovered today and confirmed today. And so it appears that there is more information there. And so just wanted to flag that for you, that right after this commission meeting this evening, we'll be visiting internally with our team and hearing from the regions all the information, the detailed about this situation. Be getting a regional recommendation from Region 1 on potential action, and that then we'll be considering that with the director this evening. So that situation continues to evolve. You all know that new information can come available at any time, and so just wanted to flag that for you and provide you that update. Any questions or anything that I missed? Or
Commissioner Keeney.
Appreciate that update, and I think lessons learned from some similar situations you've been involved with, we've all been involved with. Get this information as quickly as possible out to the public in a way that is clear, hides nothing, is based on protocol, is based on the facts, and tell the story quickly so that there's not a rumor mill get started or a information gap. And I think I'm sure you're planning to do that, but just a reminder, that seems to be where in the past, where we got into the same situation, sometimes it's easy to overlook that. So I know you won't.
Absolutely. In fact, we have staff right now while we're here working on getting that consolidated information as detailed as possible to share that with the public before the department considers any action. So that information is out there. Just also so you recall that as a result of recent litigation, that if the department, if the director were to make a decision for lethal removal, that we have a notice to the public that is 8 court hours, so that if any members of the public choose to seek a preliminary injunction or TRO, that they have that opportunity. And so I just want to make sure you're all aware of that as well. And all the information that I shared with you about the previous caught in the act, the depredations then up to May 20th, the dialogue about there's some confusion about the Togo Pack and when we named it, was it there before? All of that has already been provided on our website and for the public to see, and we'll be consolidating all that and getting that out. Okay, moving on now. And I know that we are crunched here for time, so I'm gonna adjust here, and hopefully we can cover everything and move as quickly as we possibly can. So moving on to this dialogue about roles and responsibilities for the department, the commission, and WAG in planning and process for post-delisting Wolf Conservation Management Plan. So we have, with WAG, have been talking about that for the last 3 meetings, and there has been a lot of stress in the system and not having a real clear picture for what that looks like. So at the last WAG meeting, we really tried to work to provide a roadmap, if you will. As you heard, Francine Madden has now left that third-party neutral role with WAG, and so we really wanted to have a better understanding of what that roadmap looks like moving forward for all those involved, and in this pre-planning period, kind of establish what is all the roles and responsibilities for all those involved, and talk about that and establish that before we get started. And so what you see on the screen and is in your handouts and for the public is we established a giant Velcro wall that was 20 or 30 feet long, and it had 4 layers to it. The bottom layer in green, and we're going to talk about this in more detail in a moment, was the department's SEPA process that's intertwined with conflict transformation. And so we had on cards the size of paper written down kind of the elements or the topics that are through that SEPA process. That's what you see on the bottom green, and I'm going to quickly go through that. And then what you see here is the actual Velcro wall from that day, and it's weighty because I'm doing the camera thing and I was moving. And then the remaining, the two next levels up that are the yellow and the blue. The yellow is the department planning process, and the blue is WAG. So then the WAG members provided their input on what they would like to be involved in, or what they what WAG members would actually like to have touch and be involved in and have discussions on, and what they envision being in the planning process on those next two lines. And the top line is the commission's roles and responsibilities, and Commissioner Thorburn was there, and I'll let her describe that process. So we wanted now to take what we have heard from WAG, bring that to you, and have that dialogue on what you would like to be your role in this, your responsibility, sideboards, perspectives, needs, process steps, etc. Before we get to that stage, I want to touch on a couple other processes. So I'm moving quickly here, respecting your time. So that's one process that we're initiating right now, which will be a SEPA process and EIS and that stuff. Parallel to that, you're going to see us initiate very soon a CR 101 for a periodic status review of the wolf population right now and any potential listing changes. You're also going to see we're going to be initiating very soon the SEPA process for translocation. As you know, we are directed by the legislature to start the SEPA process for considering translocation. We have started that process. We are right now recruiting for a SEPA coordinator / bio to help us move through that process. You'll be seeing that official SEPA process, the clock start ticking very soon. So we're starting and engaging on that. And then also know that there'll be processes that are going on in the federal delisting arena, and nothing new to share there. And then before we ever this process starts, there'll be that final periodic status review that takes wolves from once they reach their recovery objectives and are successfully delisted to the outcome of this, and we want to have beforehand and ready to go is a post-delisting wolf conservation management plan. So that was a big mouthful. I hope I described that well and you're following me. So I wanted to touch on, I'm about to call up some of the WAG members here. I wanted to touch on what this element looks like on the bottom part of the SEPA process. And what I've done is, it's so much detail here that I've expanded each part of the page so that you can do a better job. And I'm going to actually walk over there real quickly and walk you through some of this, and then I'll have WAG members describe what they envision.
So in JA, if you could move the microphone this way.
Oh, sure.
So I'm going to talk loud. And so in this part of the process, so again, this is exactly pictures of what the WAG members had written down and where they put them. So it's exact replication to what I had on the screen from their WAG meeting. And so on this bottom row, what we started with was just this was populated. It starts with a pre-SEPA intake where as you start SEPA, it starts with scoping and what are the kinds of questions you ask the public about what topics they want to make sure is included in the SEPA process. So it starts with some public engagement and pre-SEPA intake where we go to communities and say, what sorts of things do you want us asking your communities about what they want to see in the planning process? And then the scoping will start. Draft alternatives developed. Public input on those first draft alternatives, incorporating those into the EIS process, a first draft of the DEIS, draft EIS document, notifying the public about that, review and comment by WAG and the public and the commission, incorporate the comments into the draft EIS, respond to, of course, all comments, and then given the scope of this, will there be a second draft EIS, perhaps? And then along that process there, there will also be from a line up above here where it is, searching for it, populations persistence models. We'll be incorporating the science into that process. Yes, Commissioner.
Excuse me, Commissioner Baker.
Tiny bit of confusion.
Yes.
You talked about at least two SEPA processes, one's for translocation and one's for something else. Is what you're referring to here... My understanding of SEPA is that it's usually done on a project, and so there's a defined project, and then you go from there. So what are we SEPA-ing here?
Great. Thank you. I was moving fast through that. So you're going to see another process start that's independent of this that is SEPA for translocation.
Okay.
And then you're also going to see another process for periodic status review. While those are going on, we're going to be busy. We're going to be initiating a third process, and this is SEPA for post-delisting wolf conservation management plan. Processes are similar, so you know, knowing that. So that's what we're talking about here is all process steps and elements for post-delisting wolf conservation management plan. Thank you, Commissioner. So so we'll get to that period where we'll have, you know, maybe multiple draft EISs. We'll be incorporating the population's persistence modeling. And this will include alternatives, of course, through the SEPA process, and eventually get to a final EIS that has alternatives and a preferred alternative. So through this process, you've heard me talk about in past commission meetings, we're going to intertwine this with a conflict, what we've learned in conflict transformation, and really work with our stakeholders and our communities out there so that this is, I call it, an enhanced SEPA process, even more than what SEPA is. So from there, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to ask the WAG members to come up and talk about. They populated these lines, and what you see here are these arrows. Is coordination between this item, and it's either with C is the commission, W is WAG, D is Department of Fish and Wildlife, L is legislature, and P is public. And so, you know, this needs to be connection to the commission, and this needs to be connection to WAG and commission, and so on and so forth. I hope I'm articulating that okay. So if I could have the three WAG members come up and talk about your work, and feel free to go up to the chart and that sort of stuff. And you all know them. I was going to introduce them, but they've already talked to you.
Hello, Commission members.
Thanks for the opportunity to present this work to you. For the record, I'm Paula Swedine with Conservation Northwest and have been on the WAG since 2014. So I wanted to start with a couple just overview comments about how, at least my interpretation, and these guys can contradict or correct me if they want to, but my interpretation of this exercise we went through is that we as the WAG understand that the final decision on what the post-delisting management plan looks like is your decision. But we wanted to weigh in on particular things. And the way Francine phrased it was really helpful to us when we started the exercise, is that this whole, we took topics where the whole process would benefit if the WAG together had a discussion about it. So we're not viewing ourselves as decision makers in this. We're viewing ourselves as a body that's worked really hard to, you know, cross traditional lines that aren't usually crossed, that we've built trust and we've built relationships, and that that you would benefit hearing from ideas that we came up with. And if there's places where we actually do come to consensus, and so early on the WAG line, there's public process design, and we spent a couple meetings doing that already. There's vision, goals of the Wolf Plan, overall objectives. You know, those are all, you know, big context-setting things. And I personally believe, like, there's a chance that we could, as a body, come to consensus on some of those bigger things. When you get down the line and talk about wolf interactions or what the actual management is going to be like, personally, I envision that more being we would come up with some well-vetted set of options for you guys to consider, and there's going to be pros and cons. I think it's asking a lot. It would be asking a lot for the WAG to come up with a consensus management proposal, and you may not want that anyway. You might want more room for, more scope for decision making. But I, my understanding of our discussion is that we all felt pretty strongly that we could. Work with the social capital that we've built on the WAG and help move the discussion along in a constructive way. You know, given the controversy, given the heat behind this, that if we could do some of that processing, that it could help in your deliberations, so you weren't starting from scratch, essentially. And I think the other thing I would say, my dear friend Tom Davis in public comment this morning said that he envisioned the WAG would do sort of the vision before there was much public input. And I wanted to just, in a friendly but respectful way, provide a different opinion. I think the WAG needs to hear some public input first before we come up with a vision. Otherwise, I'm a little bit worried that our input will be viewed as, you know, a little bit too baked, or we wouldn't be genuinely taking advantage of this really careful conflict transformation informed SEPA process that's going to go on the line here. So so I just wanted to say my personal preferences, and I think the WAG will probably talk about this more, is like, what's the timing between some initial public process and listening to the public before we come up with our vision goals and objectives. So I think that's enough for me.
So to add to what Paula said, and I agree with essentially everything she said there.
Whoa.
this is my personal feeling is that, so I'm sure you can all relate to this. So WAG is a volunteer position for all of us, right? And our time is very, very important. So we want to make our time that we leave our ranches, leave our jobs, to really, really count. And so we didn't want to go through this whole process and spend a bunch of time and come up with something only to present it to the commission and have the commission go, oh, this is nothing about what we want. And so I think that's the guidance that we're asking from you, is just so that we don't kick that can so far down the road that we spend a lot of time on something that, you know, we shouldn't be spending our time on. And Francine, you know, we're like a workhorse team now. Like we argue all the time. Every meeting we have pretty heated discussions, and we always come out of it well, and we always come out of it with a at least some alternatives that everybody can sort of get behind. And so please let us do that for you. We've already done all the hard kumbaya work, team building, blah blah, right? So like, let's not waste that either. I'm sure she would be cringing if she heard me say that right now. But let us, like, we've done that hard work, and I don't want that hard work to be wasted. So please utilize us in that regard if you feel like you can. Dave?
I'm just...
No. I'm really excited about this discussion because it's really important, and I'm a logistical type person. I'm trying to figure out how is this going to work, and we have all the right people in the room, I think, to answer some of these questions or at least get us further down the road, and maybe even Harriet might have something to say about this, but the public input to me is really important, and the public input at what level, what are they expecting? You know, if we ask them, if you ask them as a WAG, and we say, great, you get a lot of public input on in each of these steps, then do we turn around and have it again? Or are we there when that public input's being asked for? Like, you've asked, I think we've had several commissioners come to meetings lately, which is great. What I'm trying to get to is a clean process where the public feels, some public may feel, I'm not talking to anybody but commissioners about this. Some people understand the WAG process and know how valuable it is because it's such a mixture of folks that have come together over time. And I think our commission needs to understand that, and I think they do. So how do we make this to where we're not wasting anybody's time? Do we need to, as a group, put power behind the WAG that's not already there? We don't give up our policy role, but do we need to come out in a way that says, you know, this is our trusted group to do some of these processes and back you? And we'll have some folks that show up at all these meetings as well. Or as I think back to how the original plan was made, the commission was out in front of the public a lot. I remember going to so many of those meetings where the commission was there taking input, as well as the group that was, and John Dawson was, or Jeff Dawson was around for that, they were taking input. And I'm just, you know, can we learn from how that plan was done and make this process go as smooth as possible, I guess, is what I'm hoping for and maybe looking for suggestions.
And I think he'll have a good response to this, but I just wanted to note, I think the way the discussions went in the WAG is that, you know, so in the green line, you'll see the first box is, you know, pre-SEPA public engagement. And so I think there's going to be multiple places where the public gets engaged. But I think a key thing that, you know, that Molly said is that the WAG is a volunteer group. So we're not the ones running the public process. The department's going to do that. And to the extent that WAG members can go to these different venues for getting input from the public, we will. But regardless, department staff, my understanding, will bring that information to WAG and to WAG meetings, and that we will hear what was learned if we can't make it there ourselves. And that's sort of in the early stages. And then there's going to be, I'm sure, as alternatives are drafted in the SEPA process, there's going to be a lot of, you know, outreach and public meetings, which I'm guessing you guys will be very involved in. So leave it with that.
So I would also say that I think what WAG is asking from the commission is sideboards for us to work within, right? And so I never even occurred to me having commission members go to public meetings. I don't think that's necessarily what's, and by law, we note that you take in the comments at these public meetings and you have to address them in the SEPA process, right? So all those comments will be taken in, but I think that's the appropriate role of the department to do that. And then those comments will help guide the information that the WAG is disseminating to the commission. So that's how I see it.
So I'll just add to that, and I'm not going to go through all the detail there, is that in many places on the line for the department, you'll see over and over again the outreach. And so we do know that the importance of this subject matter, we need to reach a tremendous part of Washington and all the corners and all of our communities. And so that's where we really see it as an enhanced SEPA, not the bare minimum SEPA requirements, but something much greater than that, where we're trying to reach out to as many communities and the diversity as we can on the outreach throughout this process.
Well, Commissioner Thorburn had a question.
Well, actually, it's a comment on the process. One of the outstanding moments at the last WAG meeting for me was when Molly stood up and said, somebody came up to me, I'm going to get this all wrong, but somebody came up to me and said, the regular public or something like that.
Right. Regular public.
Yeah. And Molly goes, I am the regular public. But then Francine kind of reminded WAG members that there is a selection process and you do have a sort of a responsibility of representation is how I would sum it up. And when I first met Francine 4 years ago, we talked a lot about CCT, and one of the my understanding of the processes was that it is made up of representatives of communities of disparate views. And so I would ask of the WAG and your public process that you be that you're representatives of your community, meaning you're out, you know, understanding and interpreting for us those ideas, views, concerns, and you know, without necessarily formal process. The WAG doesn't have a big public testimony period because there's a lot of work going on in those meetings. So public testimony during WAG meetings is not even the degree that we have here at commission meetings. So I think there's a different kind of public process that is involved with the WAG, and that's what I would hope would come from your work.
And as WAG members, we also talked about, I totally acknowledge what you're saying, about sort of cross-pollinating those open public meetings that are run by the department. And for example, I'll drive over the pass and go through Seattle traffic and be scared the whole time. So that there's producers at open public meetings where producers maybe, so that they can answer questions mm-hmm. if there's questions for our community.
Right.
So, we will not let the department slack on the open public process.
maybe Donnie or any one of you folks, you're asking us to provide you sideboards. I guess I'm asking you to give us a little bit more detail about what that means to you, because I kind of got it and then I lost it again. So,
yeah, I'm going to walk over here real quick.
And I realize this may not, we may be time crunched here, and so we may need to come back to you to do this. But at this stage, what I was envisioning is to, and I was going to capture it on flip charts. We love flip charts and WAG, by the way, and just level transparency. But we can do that another time, whatever you prefer. But really what we want is, what would this look like for you in this scope of how does the commission and WAG communicate without stepping on each other's toes? What are the interim and final products of the commission? Commission needs to hear about WAG CCT to understand how to work together. And so it's a process where
if it's department, WAG, and commission, I'm just doing a hand symbol here, where we're working like this and communicating early on and throughout so that we don't go like this. And so we'd want to hear from you of what, if you were to populate this, and I were to capture it here, is what process steps do you want to have? How often do you want to engage? Do you want us to work through the Wildlife Committee, or is there a Wolf Committee? What elements do you want to engage on? Vision or objectives or you know, alternatives and all of that. So your needs, your perspectives, what sideboards are you envisioning for the department and for WAG? All of those kinds of things. And so that will probably take more time, and we would come back to you and hear your input. In between now and then, we can talk more and be thinking about what are those elements you would share with us that you'd like to provide and to make sure that we are all working like this.
Commissioner Keeney.
I'm getting a better feel, and I'm getting some ideas now that I can hopefully clarify. When the original Wolf Conservation Plan was written, I remember it was very early on. I don't even think there was, maybe there was one pack. No, there wasn't even a pack in the state yet. But there was a meeting in Colville, and the whole commission went to that meeting, and it was just on wolves. And it was just to hear, because I was sent there for Conservation Northwest to say, what's all that about? And I remember going to that meeting, and there was a lot of input from the public, and it wasn't even as riled up as it got later in time. But that's a role we can't delegate. That's why we're here, is to get that one-on-one testimony, input from people about what's going on. And I guess I'm starting to see a pathway through this now that I didn't have before, is that if we're any advisory group the commission is blessed to have, because you can put time in on it, it's the dispersion groups that can work together and give us input. And I think there's a point at which, though, we have to take what you've given us and then test it out with the public. And whereas you wouldn't have that much public input at any of your meetings, we need to have that. So I think there's going to be a point at which you would say, we're this far along on our flow chart, here's what we have. It comes through department, it comes through the WAG process. Commission, it's your time to test that out and get out there, whether it's at these sessions in Olympia or out in the public, and say, we need to get that 3 minutes of testimony from everybody that wants to talk about that part. And hopefully then we're not going to reach the end where things blow up. We've had a progressive process of people giving input at the right level. We're relying on the WAG for the right processes and things to be developed, and I think it can work pretty well.
Paula?
So thank you for that, Commissioner Keeney, and that that raises a point that maybe we weren't very clear on, is that I don't think that the WAG's deliberations on the elements that we thought were important for us to talk about, that we're not going to do those in the absence of there being more public process than happens just at WAG meetings. And we recognize that there's a big difference between the discussions that we had, say, on the Wolf Livestock Interaction Protocol, because that was something that was already decided within the context of SEPA, and you guys already gave your blessing to what was in the plan. This is much bigger. And so, you know, we've spent at least two WAG meetings and part of a third since March talking about what this larger public engagement process is going to look like. And there is lots and lots of ideas about, you know, different venues and venues that were more appropriate for the livestock community and more appropriate for the hunting community and more appropriate for the conservation community or urban populations versus rural populations. And that's a piece that I think that the department is going to orchestrate in terms of setting that up. But, you know, if WAG members aren't there physically, and I think a lot of us will try, and like Molly said, she's willing to come over to the west side, I'm willing to go up to northeast or southeast or anywhere, and I think other WAG members are willing to do that kind of traveling, that will inform our deliberations. So this won't look like past WAG meetings where all we do is, you know, have, you know, there's an open public house beforehand and then there's you know, comment at the end of each day. That's not how we're going to structure, you know, hearing from the public for our deliberations. And then you obviously you're going to have your own preference about how you guys engage with the public. But whatever we give to you isn't just going to be, you know, us talking amongst ourselves.
Commissioner Baker.
So far, to me, it seems a bit chicken and egg-ish. And the other thing, so I believe that this body can react appropriately and responsively to alternatives. And I also believe that the department can do a good public engagement campaign. I would like to be kept apprised of what that is, because I think that's critical, and I think we have some examples, in fact, recent examples of some not good ones. And so I think that's critical. But the thing that made me a little uncomfortable about this whole discussion is that there seems to be at least a hope, maybe an impression, that we speak with one voice, and we don't. And we don't have the, we have not, well, I think probably most of us put in time extra from these meetings, but certainly not the amount of time you all put in together going through this with facilitation. We don't have that, and we can't have that. So it's going to be a bit rocky for us figuring this out. I believe I speak for everybody that you have our full commitment, and I'm also going to say one more time, it's just not too late to change your mind. But I would like to say that I don't know that it would be possible for us, without being hurtful, I think, to the process, to provide the sideboards you're looking for in advance of or any time real soon.
Can I address that a little bit? So when I say sideboards, I mean a sideboard might be that the commission is 100% hands-off. But what that does for us is then we know what the expectation is. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you're saying the commission has give us a product at the end of the process, and that's what you say, and it's on public record and written down, then those are our sideboards. But we are an advisory group. We do not want to overstep our bounds. We're very, very sensitive to that. And so this wasn't meant to put a whole bunch of tasks on the commission. This was more just so that we know that we are going down the correct path, because we're about to launch. Does that help?
Mr. Graybill.
This is almost more to take in than Jay's motion earlier.
Yes.
Just from my perspective, I know that department staff has a lot of experience of going through the CEPA process, which is one of the, there's three layers to this discussion today. And so they understand process, and I think they can give guidance to the WAG about where what the roadmap is. Now, you fill in the bricks that go into that road, very much so, and I'm very dependent on advisory group opinion, particularly when you've been able to arrive at consensus on something as contentious as the wolf issues. And then I would expect, at appropriate intervals, to get an update. So I know where you are, so I can understand where we are in the process, so that I know that you're comfortable with sort of the consensus of the group at that interval, and it's making progress along the appropriate lines of the CEPA process guided by staff. And then if I know kind of where we are at that point in time, and if there's options that you say, okay, we're at a fork here. We need to know whether we should go this way or that way. Then I would like to be appraised of that. But I don't want to impose, certainly not my opinion, because I just don't have enough information to provide you with an opinion on this. Right? But that, just to give you an idea where I'm sitting right now. That's my vision.
Commissioner Thorburn and then Commissioner Holzman. Okay, you first.
Okay. I have to hearken back to a story I heard between the difference between management and leadership. They had a group was cutting a trail through the forest, and they brought in a new management team, and man, they were sharpening axes, and man, they were making great time. All of a sudden, they kind of got to a rise on the hill, and somebody crawled up a tree and said, "Hey, we're headed in the wrong direction." They hollered back, "Shut up, we're making good time." That's where I will go back to Molly's sideboards and what Donnie was saying, that we need to be headed into the same direction. And I think that's where, you know, there again, there's nine of us with nine different views. But I truly do believe in my heart of hearts that we kind of have to be at the end product to have a pretty good idea if we're headed north, south, east, or west. So I think that's where, and I spoke to this in Spokane, and to that end, after attending the WAG, I come away with 1,000% faith in your process, because there was butcher bakers and candlestick makers sitting around that table. And at the end of the day, I felt anything that we got from you was going to be well talked through and a diversity of ideas. But I think the more communications we have and that we're pointed in the right direction, the more important and the better product at the end.
Mr. Thorburn.
So my comments on sideboards as well. I will be ashamed, commissioners, if we give a sideboard that just go anywhere. I recognize that we have a diversity of opinions about this at this point. At some point, we're going to take some votes on it, however. I think that it is important that if we were to give sort of a blank sideboard like that, that we definitely end up going like this, and that we do need to give direction, even if it's this needs to be on the table in your considerations, and this is definitely off the table in your considerations. I really think we need to be there, and we've got some hard work to do because we're kind of all over the place, but I've got strong opinions, and I've got things that I want to see on the table. So,
Donnie?
Great discussion, commissioners, and I really value everything you're saying. I'm taking notes, and of course we'll have your audio. Vice Chair, just a reminder, so we do have the I'm not trying to hush you at all, just want to remind you that we do have three other department staff here. They're going to do a science presentation to you. It takes about 20 or 30 minutes, and I just wanted to do a process check on time just because I didn't want you to forget about our folks that would not know that we had that also today. So however you'd like to proceed.
We can probably provide them with 20 minutes, I would guess. Okay. I guess I just want to say one thing. There's been some great discussions. Donnie, I don't think I need an answer today, or we need an answer today, but as far as briefings from this group, a subgroup like this, or however you want to decide to do it, I guess I'd kind of like some idea how often you would want to come in front of the commission. I don't know that you'd want to come every meeting. I don't know that that there would be enough substance to talk about every meeting that we have. But three times a year, four times a year, I just give that some thought and get back to us. What do you think is practical for you folks and good and healthy for us as well?
You bet. Absolutely. We'll bring that to you.
Commissioner Keeney.
I'll be quick. And I just want to make sure as we start down this path, because like Molly says, we're starting down it, we have to visualize the future. And because you're really creating a plan for the future. So. The future will involve, I don't know, 500 wolves, some large number of wolves in our state. Most territories full, or they would be filled up within a few years. Donnie gave a description today of one pack, one problem situation that is occurring. It will take a considerable amount of time of this department, I would guess. Multiply that. In your plan of how you're going to develop this, I think you have to have that clear picture of what it's going to look like as you start to work that direction. We all do, as you start to work towards what does the conservation and management plan look like at full recovery. Have a good grasp of what full recovery means in our state.
Thank you. And I should have before, but so diversity here. Molly represents the livestock community, Dave the hunting community, and Paula the environmental or conservation community on WAG. And so thank you all so much.
Thank you very much, Donnie. It's 12:15. We'll go to 12:35.
So, great. Thank you.
Right. Yep.
No stress, folks.
Well, it's all 2 minutes past, so we're down to 18.
Thank you, Dave. So Candace Bennett, our conflict specialist, is going to join us. Dr. Ben Maletsky, our wolf specialist, and Dr. Scott McCorkendale, our Region 3 wildlife program manager, and they're going to lead us through the presentation.
First of all, I please don't take our "we're in a hurry" as an eye poke. We appreciate you coming and doing it. It's just we have a big book here, though. Take it away.
Well, thank you, everyone. As Donnie said, my name is Candace Bennett, and I just want to say hello to the commission chair and other commissioners. Some I know and see fairly regularly. New director. It looks like the AD stepped out. So what we wanted, I'll let others introduce themselves, or are you guys comfortable, so we can get through it? Okay. So what we wanted to come and bring to you guys is a brief summary of a wolf advisory group section that we had in March, and just wanted to walk you through kind of how that came about, and then finally go over a couple of those concepts that were in there. So we also provided a couple pieces of material. So the WAG meeting notes from March, specifically those pages that were explicit to this literature review, introductory literature review. And then also, too, we wanted to share, we had put together an Excel spreadsheet of some of the literature that we did review. Just be aware that, you know, that's a small subset, and we'll talk a little bit about that, about some of the literature that's available. So as we started to have the conversation about this postee listing and the department's role in the WAG and having these discussions, we had started getting questions from WAG members. And then also, you know, as I said before, I'm a conflict specialist, so I'm hearing a lot of these questions about, like, what is this going to look like in this next phase of wolf recovery in Washington? And we put those all down on paper. So we had questions ranging from, what's it going to look like? You know, are wolves going to, you know, totally decimate ungulate populations? What does that look like? You know, is there, you know, prey switching? What does that look like? And so we compiled all of those together to really get us to, you know, where do we start providing the literature, you know, and just kind of this initial dipping our toe in with the WAG. And we really broke it down to four different topics, very broad topics. So wolf population dynamics, the predator-prey dynamics, ungulate populations, and then an acknowledgement from the investment from the department and externally the conflict, the CCT, the conservation conflict transformation. And so we wanted to put those together. Amongst, we also had a group of staff that reviewed, I think, 19 different management plans that we could discuss with the WAG. As we first started going through this process, we wanted to make a couple acknowledgments. As I said before, this topic is a huge topic in the literature, and that there's a lot of different resources that we could have pulled from. Like I said, predominantly we focused on peer-reviewed literature and then also management plans from other states. But knowing that, and we talked about it a little later, that there is also this interest in the popular articles and opinions versus kind of this peer-reviewed. But for this initial step, we really wanted to just kind of hone in on those two main topics. I keep saying this because I think it's really important. As we had multiple conference calls, getting feedback externally and then with WAG, was that we really wanted to kind of dip our toe in, take those initial questions that we were receiving, and then vet it through the WAG process, get feedback on the things that they'd like to hear, as well as how do we incorporate this piece in WAG as we move forward. One of the things, too, that we had a discussion about is that an acknowledgement that, you know, there is this piece where science sometimes, you know, some can grab onto certain literature and they hold it and it becomes a value system. And so we wanted to try to be sensitive to that. But then also, too, like I said, as part of that feedback loop, learn from that as well. And then we also acknowledge, as we were kind of getting into this, there's few actual research articles that really examine kind of management actions. We really had to kind of lean heavier in this initial review on management plans from other states. So the reason why we provided the minutes or the notes from that March WAG meeting to you guys is because it was this very organic, fluid conversation that we had at the WAG, and we really couldn't recreate that for you, and so we wanted to make sure that we provided the minutes. The only piece out of that whole several-hour conversation that we did have that we actually can recreate is Scott's piece, which we'll do here in a minute. But amongst that conversation, we did tap on to those. We had about 20 questions and concepts that we had identified initially to help us wade through the literature. We actually touched on some of those, and it was a great learning experience for us to see kind of what we wanted, hearing from the public afterwards as well. What can we do as department staff to bring that forward and to help that discussion? And so I will turn it over to Scott to do his piece. At the very beginning, we wanted to kick it off with a piece where to really outline that kind of what we were thinking when we started this process. So
thanks, Candace. So the March WAG meeting, I think, really represented a transition in the conversation within WAG. The last several years to date, that conversation and a lot of the sort of intellectual energy had been focused on wolf-livestock interactions. And WAG had done a ton of work, and they'd accomplished a ton of stuff. And so much progress so that we could now start contemplating talking about what wolf management look like in the future in a delisted state. So this was the point in which we were going to begin to talk about a number of things, but among those things would be the scientific literature that was relevant to these topics. It wasn't really, as Candace indicated, it wasn't really intended to be the conversation. It was more to be the conversation about how the conversation was going to develop. And it's really just begun. I was asked to just provide some introductory comments about kind of the wrestling with the scientific literature. And it may seem odd to you that a regional manager from Yakima was asked to do this. And the reason I think I was asked to do it is I've only been a regional manager for a little while. I spent most of my career as a research scientist doing research, publishing research, peer-reviewing research for a number of journals, and for the last 15 years I've also been an associate editor for the Journal of Wildlife Management. So I think it was that I might have perspectives that would be valuable to WAG, and so I was asked to just kick off the conversation with a few introductory comments. So I noted that the goal of scientific research is often to understand relationships between processes, relationships between things, relationships between processes and things, and that's challenging. The holy grail, obviously, is always cause and effect. We'd always like to know, what is it that drives phenomena? What drives an outcome? How strong is that influence? In the physical sciences, it's pretty straightforward. You can do a nice controlled experiment where the only variation you have in the experiment is manipulating the thing that you think is important and measuring an outcome. In ecological research, it doesn't work that way. We're interested in these processes like predation or a number of other things that are they're processes that are occurring within systems that have an incredible amount of variation. Every year the weather is different. Every year the population is different. And so it's really the classical struggle to find the signal and the noise. And there's a lot of noise in the ecological systems that you cannot control. Good experimental designs help you, but they'll never be as good as a classical controlled experiment. WAG, the department, the public has a lot of interest in terms of wolves about what are the effects of wolves and wolf predation going to be on ungulate populations, other than not the livestock, but the wild ungulate populations. That's a really important question, but it's a really complicated question. And My honest answer is going to be that it depends, and it depends on a number of things. It's not a very satisfactory answer to say that it depends, but it does. It depends on the numbers of any particular prey item. It depends on the numbers of other alternative prey items. It depends on the number of wolves. It depends on the number of other predators that might also be impacting those ungulate populations. It depends on the weather. It depends on where the population of ungulates is relative to carrying capacity. All these things are important to the outcome. That's why when we begin to look at this huge body of literature, they don't all say the same thing. Outcomes look different in different places, and it's because those systems are different. There's different levels of complexity in all those systems, and that matters not a little bit, but a huge amount. I also noted for WAG that there are sort of some things I'd encourage them to keep in mind as they thought about the literature and read the literature together. Single, well-done studies that provide some sort of information, that's great. But science is always stronger if there's replication, and you begin to see that those same sorts of outcomes are emerging in different places and in different systems. Broad process hypotheses are really difficult to test. So what we normally do is we make predictions that are consistent with those hypotheses, and it's really the predictions that we test, not the broad hypotheses. Reminded them to remember that despite what you read in many letters to the editor, statistically, science doesn't prove anything. Science works under the premise of trying to disprove all the alternative explanations, and when you eliminate pretty much all of them except the one that you really think is driving it and you still have a consistent result, that's where you begin to make strong inference. The things that make strong inference more difficult are small sample sizes, effect sizes that are small, and samples that have inherently a lot of variation. So those were things that I suggested that WAG kind of keep in mind as we interacted. In the last 20 years or so, research has often kind of moved in the direction of not just trying to test for differences, but also to try to produce generalizable results, trying to do more of a modeling approach where you can actually predict outcomes in other places. The last comments that I made to WAG were that scientists need not just to be brilliant, they need to be relevant. And so all of this occurs, the most powerful research occurs in this interface between the science of the system and people. And I quoted Jack Ward Thomas. Jack Ward Thomas, probably a lot of you know, have heard that name. He's probably arguably the most famous wildlife biologist in North America. He was the only one that ever became the chief of the Forest Service. And he wrote one time, "In the U.S., wildlife biologists live and work in a democracy. Public opinion always counts. Pretending otherwise is folly. Long-term success requires public consensus and appropriate compromise. The role of science and scientists is to inform and enlighten those charged with making decisions, ordinarily, not to make the decisions themselves." And so that's kind of that. Those were the comments that I offered.
So, yeah, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Another discussion. Go ahead, please.
4 minutes. All right. No, moving quick. No, so some of these processes,
you actually get 10 or 15 because we're going to change our lunch, so we don't want to short you. So,
appreciate that. So. Thank you very much. So,
his heart rate just went down.
Right, yeah, dropping down a notch.
Anyway.
No, we'll keep moving. I know everybody's hungry. When we had these discussions, this was really an introduction to the WAG members and a learning experience for all of us, too. And we want to start this discussion, and share our knowledge, but also learn from everybody on WAG. And that's just the dynamic of WAG. And so some of those concepts that kind of rose through those questioning, we wanted to talk about three things, and Candace had mentioned them earlier: carrying capacity, density dependence, and additive and compensatory mortality were kind of three things that kind of rose as some of these processes that influence populations. So I've got a couple slides just to describe what those are to help folks out. And so this is a slide on carrying capacity. And you can see the population is on the y-axis and time over time. Those populations fluctuate in size, and there's a number of factors that influence those populations. When a population carrying capacity is kind of that equilibrium where there's just enough resources to keep those animals alive on the landscape at the maximum amount of animals that landscape can have. And it can be a rolling, because those populations are dynamic, and there's individuals born every year and births and deaths and animals dying, those populations change, and that's based on influence of the populations like predation or resources, forage that's available to ungulate populations, and weather and climate and things that influence those populations. Down lower on the curve, as that population is growing to carrying capacity, those factors are all influencing those populations. But the animals, because there's fewer animals, there's more resources available to those animals. And so it's important to understand that those lower population levels, those animals are probably in better condition. Those individuals may be better fed. Their reproductive success may be higher. Their survival may be higher, actually, at those lower levels. When they reach carrying capacity, those density-dependent factors, which, Kenneth, can you flip that slide? Density-dependent factors can kick in on that population. And a density dependence is a factor that acts in proportion to the density animals. So as the density goes up and that population reaches carrying capacity, the availability of forage becomes less available to each of those individuals. They may be more susceptible to predation. There may be intraspecific competition, so competition between individuals on the landscape. Territoriality. In carnivores like cougars or wolves, where there's just only so much space available for a pack to establish without competing with an adjacent pack. Because animals are closer together, disease may come into play, or emigration, where animals are leaving the population because there's too many animals, there's not enough food, they can find better resources elsewhere. And so those are the dependent factors that are as that population reaches carrying capacity. And there's other things that can influence that population. If those individuals are at carrying capacity and they're not as in as good a condition, those severe winters, deep snow, ice on snow events, extended cold, drought, human impacts, those things can have impacts on that population. And so we need to be aware of that. And then there's other things that can help bolster that population. If you happen to have a mild winter or fall rain to green up some of those areas, those can help increase habitat enhancements. Things can increase those populations. And so, hit the next slide. So, just kind of as I was mentioning, as those populations are below carrying capacity, those individuals are actually probably in a better body condition because they're getting a lot of the resources. There's a plethora of resources available to them. And so when they are faced with environmental stresses or a tough winter, they may actually be more suited to get through those stresses easier. As that population reaches carrying capacity, a larger proportion of those individuals in that population may actually be in poor body condition because some may be more on the periphery of that good habitat, and they're all competing for that space out there. And then that also makes them more susceptible to those limiting factors. Those severe winters, drought, disease can actually have a bigger impact on that population as a whole. And so... And then as the other concept, too, that we talked about and discussed and you know, these concepts are tough. There's chapters and textbooks and things, and so four slides is really tough to convey a lot of this information when there's so much about there. But additive mortality is when an animal dies from a certain cause. If that hadn't happened, that animal would have likely persisted and contributed to the population growth. So by losing that animal, you're decreasing that population. Compensatory mortality is a type of mortality where if every year there's X amount of animals that are born to that population, but the carrying capacity only allows so many on the landscape. And so if that animal dies from predation, it doesn't impact that population growth because that population with those newborn of the year were above that carrying capacity. And so that animal, some other mortality factor would have replaced it, like starvation or another source of mortality. And so these concepts are ones that we wanted to share and explain. There's a lot of information out there on this further, but it's just kind of just getting familiar with some of the processes that affect populations. And so we kind of have an example here Scott's going to go into.
How are we doing for time?
You're doing okay.
Okay, so we thought it would be potentially informative just to kind of talk about an example that's really well known. So the Northern Yellowstone elk herd. And the Northern Yellowstone elk herd, as you can see from this graph, had this inflection point about 1969 where it grew rapidly after somewhat of a period of stability. And then the line there in 1995 was when wolves were introduced. And there was a subsequent dramatic decline in wolves. And so wolves came in 95, rapid decline in elk numbers, and we know that elk has been the primary prey for wolves in Yellowstone. So that seems like a fairly simple thing, right? So wolves ate a lot of elk and drove the population down. The inflection point in 1969, that's the point in which the Park Service adopted the policy of natural regulation. They stopped managing elk within the boundary of the park. Montana continued to manage outside the park, but prior to that time there had been a concerted effort to keep elk numbers down in that lower level. Okay. So other things were going on, though, which sort of add complexity to this. So this is just the harvest data for removals by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks via their seasons outside of the park for the northern range. And their ability to remove elk from that part of the landscape really vary annually because of the winter conditions had a big effect on how many elk were in or out of the park. But you can see, for example, 1993, there were almost 4,500 elk removed via hunting from that population. In 1997, there were about 3,000. So Montana didn't want as many elk on the northern range as were developing after the policy of natural regulation was adopted. So Montana continued to work pretty hard to bring that elk herd down via hunting and took a lot of elk out of the system at the same time that, you know, prior to and then at the same time as wolves were just beginning to sort of take over there. So the other things that were going on at this time is grizzly bears were rapidly growing. Grizzly bear population in 1975 in the system when they were listed as threatened, estimates were as low as 140 bears. There are now somewhere between 700 and 1,000 grizzly bears, and in fact they've been delisted. Grizzly bears eat neonatal elk, they eat little elk. So whereas wolves have a fitness filter, they pay a penalty for trying to attack something that's strong and fit, and they typically are looking for animals that have some vulnerability. Bears are eating neonates, and there is not the strongest elk calf alive is not going to break the jaw of a grizzly bear. So grizzly bears do not have a fitness filter. They just have a can-I-catch-it filter. And so their predation effects tend to be more additive than compensatory. Wolves often have more compensatory effects. So one last piece of this is that bison on this range grew eightfold during the same time frame. So there are all these things going on that certainly had an effect on elk numbers. People have been studying this system for 25 years. The wolf people, the elk people, think wolves have some role in this, but they also think it's a really complicated equation and that it's not as simple as maybe it first looks. So just kind of an example of how teasing out what the effect of predation by wolves in Yellowstone is, that's not a really easy thing to figure out because of all the other things. You can read the summary pieces, just again pointing out the complexity of these systems varies and that really has a strong effect. Science in some areas is still evolving. And then the recognition as we move forward that wildlife management isn't just about what good wildlife science, it's about being relevant and integrating that with social values. Thank you.
Very good. Wrap up, Donnie?
I would like to, yes, thank you. So to kind of put a bow on all of that for you, so as thank you presenters talked about, so there is on the back table a list of a number of studies that they all have looked at and many more. And just wanted to state that kind of as they talked about, to use an example of what kind of impact will wolves have on ungulates, to just use that as an example. There is a myriad of science out there that can describe that from way on this side to way on that side, and we aren't making any of those our position. You know, our job is to look at Washington populations, both wolf and ungulate, to make sure we're monitoring ungulates, and if there are impacts on ungulates, that we detect those. And as the presenters talked about, that's going to be complicated. It depends. It will likely, if it occurs, and it may, it has occurred in other states and other jurisdictions, and it will be at that local scale, kind of at a GMU level, where you start to see if there are impacts like that, that they will there occur. And so there isn't a standard global universal statement that says that wolves will just maintain themselves at this level and have no impact. It's trickier than that. It's more complicated than that. And so we're going to do our due diligence to be monitoring ungulate populations and wolf populations so that if it does happen, we detect it early.
Any questions? Well,
that was the point.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I think we got most of it, but probably more to come. So look forward to hearing more in the future.
Thank you. And sorry we
No, we're good.
Into your
we're
lunch
good.
Hour.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we are.